You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Got an exciting show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking about all kinds of things. Tomorrow there's actually some Republican primaries, and I know you're thinking to yourself, well, Mitt Romney's already got this locked up. You've probably forgotten that Newt Gingrich is still running for president. And I think that's probably what many Republican voters have forgotten as well. I'm not even sure if Newt Gingrich knows he's still running for president at this point. We're going to be talking about that and other issues throughout the day. Tom and Louise are out today, maybe tomorrow. As you probably know, Louise is having surgery, and they will be reading. There's a post on the message boards at tomhartman.com. They'll be keeping up to date and reading that for your well wishes, thoughts, and prayers. So I don't want to spend too much time on that, but go ahead and check that out. They'll be reading your comments. Like I said, we've got an exciting show lined up today. I have been reading a little bit about Newt Gingrich's campaign, if only for, you know, for the purposes of being a historian. It's just getting to the point at which you wonder if he can survive the image blow that he's going to be taking here. He's looking more and more pathetic every day that goes by. Tuesday, tomorrow, there are primaries in Connecticut, Delaware, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. All of those states would probably benefit Mitt Romney, even if the races were a little bit more contentious. And Newt Gingrich is still holding event after event. You know, it's probably more likely to be part of his wife's book tour. But I couldn't think of anybody else to talk about this and a few other things that I'd rather chat with than Eric Burns. He is a co-founder of Bullfight Strategies, my business partner at Bullfight Strategies. It's great to welcome to the show. Hey, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me, Carl.
Absolutely. So at what point does the scale tip towards pathetic for Newt Gingrich? He's still running, and he must think he's getting something out of this. I don't know if it's just to pay down the huge debt that he's incurred, that he's ended up with. But what's the point?
I'm not sure what you're talking about. Is there still a primary?
Yeah, exactly. Newt Gingrich is still running. He's still got events. He was in, I think, Delaware yesterday saying that, you know, Mitt Romney's going to be able to raise more money than me. Yeah, but I've got the people with me.
And I mean, I guess it's in his mind, it's like, you know, first Delaware and then the world. You know, I don't know at this point.
Or the moon. What,
it's like something out of Pinky, the cartoon Pinky and the Brain, as you've heard me say many times. You know, what I really like about his North Carolina schedule is that he's going to be going to the zoo.
Right.
Where they apparently don't have penguins. They have puffies, though I'm not really sure what those are.
Either am I. But I know that there's like a blog dedicated to Newt Gingrich with zoo animals.
Yeah, but it's like a city council race, you know, right. I mean, when you look at the events that he's doing, and it just really, you know, it can only be Newt's ego that is keeping him in this, because he's actually sitting there kind of, you know, acting like, well, Newt, you know, Romney doesn't have the numbers, when we, of course, everyone in the world except Newt Gingrich knows that Newt Gingrich is not going to be the nominee.
But Eric, we know that science and shapes and letters and numbers and math have a well-known quantifiable liberal bias.
This is true. This is true, and obviously Newt Gingrich, you know, clearly isn't affected by that liberal bias
no.
at all.
Well, I mean, is it too crass to assume the only reason that Newt Gingrich is still in this race is for the same reason he got into this race, to sell books and hawk merchandise? Right now his wife, let me clarify, I'm getting news that this is his third wife, that this is all part of his wife's book tour, and that it's to sell her books. Is that what it is?
I mean, you know, look, it could be that. I mean, Newt Incorporated is a term that we throw around here all the time in Washington, because he's done very well promoting himself. You know, I do think that there's a part of Newt Gingrich that, you know, fancies himself as this great conservative champion. And now that, you know,
it's true.
He's in his own mind, you know,
right.
I mean, he did do it in 94 before he was, you know, cast out of the House for, you know, ethics violations. But I really think that he is trying to represent this part of the party that we, of course, saw emerge, you know, with the Tea Party and then took full, you know, front and center stage with Rick Santorum and the cycle, Rick Perry and all these candidates that we went through that just don't like Mitt Romney.
Well, he wasn't even, you know, at its core, he wasn't even their second, third, or fourth choice.
You're right.
I mean, there is that element of the party. And, I mean, you're seeing it with all these people that are now endorsing Mitt Romney, whether it's Paul Ryan or others who basically come out and say, well, the election's over, so I'm endorsing Mitt Romney now that he's the only guy left.
Yeah. Well, and so, yeah, it kind of begs the question, why isn't Newt Gingrich doing that? And I guess, you know, either Newt wants to be a wing of the Republican Party of one, like an army of one,
right,
or he really does want to try to be the standard bearer, you know, going forward for this, you know, new super, super conservative, you know, wing of the Republican Party that's to the right of Genghis Khan. But it doesn't really fit with Gingrich's history and who he is, and you know he's not exactly a family values poster candidate. And honestly, Carl, I just you know, obviously, look, Newt Gingrich is a very very smart man, and I don't think anybody would really question that. But he has the flights of fancy that you know, when he's talking about putting moon bases, you know.
I would question whether or not he's a smart man at this point.
Hey, you can be insane. Well, certainly not a wise man.
Right.
I think that your assessment is fair, that he's clearly getting a lot of, you know, something personal out of this, which is personal promotion. And it's a little sad to see because this is a, you know, our process to elect our president is supposed to be a serious one and not one that you, just continue to hang on for to make some money. But that's the world we live in.
Well, and, you know, he's not just, perhaps paying down his debt, making some money. He's costing taxpayers a lot of money, too. He's still got a Secret Service detail. And as Bill Maher said, I guess, on Friday night, he said that Newt Gingrich is still receiving Secret Service protection. What are they protecting him from? Reality? Eric, are you there? All right, well, it seems we've lost Eric. We'll try and reconnect with him. I want to know what you think about Newt Gingrich's campaign, if you can even call it a campaign. Give us a call. Toll free 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. There are other candidates, if you didn't know it, other than Newt Gingrich that are running for president. there's Mitt Romney. And according to a study by the Pew Center, which is a nonpartisan organization, the media favored Romney over Obama during the GOP primaries. I understand we've got Eric Burns back with us. Is Eric, are you there?
Sorry about that, Carl. Technical difficulties.
No problem. So I'm talking about we've got this report from the Pew Center that says the media favored Romney over Obama during the GOP primaries. It's a pretty detailed study. Eric, can you stick around after this break and chat with me about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you haven't seen it, you can go look up Howard Kurtz's piece in the Daily Beast. About this, these startling numbers, Mitt Romney getting almost twice the positive coverage that President Obama received during this long, never-ending freak show known as the Republican primaries. This is the Tom Hartman program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. And when we come back, we'll talk more about this study. We'll also take your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We're talking to Eric Burns. He's the former president of Media Matters. He's my business partner at Bullfight Strategies. I'm sure he's got a lot to say about that. You never know. Eric might be quiet when it comes to how biased the media has been in favor of Mitt Romney. I doubt it, though. We'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, the media is in the tank for Mitt Romney.
By the end of my second term, we will have the first permanent base on the moon, and it will be American.
Welcome back, my friends. Mega News. A RESPA with the EIB Network. The media is in the tank for Obama.
I'm sorry, that was a really hacky impersonation of Rush Limbaugh. But, you know, whenever you see these studies, now granted, this is a study, which means it has numbers. And as we all know, numbers and studies are liberal bias in their truest form. But whenever I see one of these studies that shows how completely pathetic it is to argue that there is liberal media bias out there, I'm shocked that we don't talk more about it. If you're just joining us, filling in for Tom Hartman today, I'm Carl Frisch. I'm joined by Eric Burns, my business partner at Bullfight Strategies, which you can find at bullfightstrategies.com. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric_E_Burns. We've got this study from Pew, the Center for Excellence in Journalism, and I just want to read a little bit from this Howard Kurtz report and then get Eric's take on it. During the bruising Republican primaries, there was one candidate whose coverage was more relentlessly negative than the rest. In fact, he did not enjoy a single week where positive treatment by the media outweighed negative. Overall, it was no contest. From January 2nd through April 15th, Romney's coverage was 39% positive, 32% negative, and 29% neutral, this study found. Obama's coverage was 18% positive, 34% negative, and 34% neutral, which means that Romney's depiction in the media was more than twice as positive as the president. So much for liberal bias, right, Eric?
I mean, this is ridiculous, and it's something that, working at Media Matters, obviously, we set out to regularly do these kinds of studies and reports, at least when I was there, and were able to demonstrate these exact same patterns whenever we would start counting. It did not look good for this whole liberal media bias myth. And, Carl, I started off as a young Republican operative in my youth in Texas, and I actually learned.
Everybody experiments when they're younger, Eric.
That's right. That's right. They do.
Most people don't choose politics, but.
Well, it was safer than other options. But, I learned from Republicans how to do press and tactics and strategy. And I will tell you that I didn't even buy it then when I was a Republican working in Texas, that as a press secretary, that there was a liberal media bias. I mean, because it never has rung true to me.
Well, it's never rung true to me, because to know bias is to know what somebody is thinking. And that implies like witchcraft. And you never picture Republicans being, into like witchcraft or mind reading or anything like that.
Never, except maybe once or twice. But, this is what's really, really important and a little bit sinister about the right and the fact that we are now having to do these studies. The Pew is doing studies on so-called liberal media bias because, there's an organization called the Media Research Center that's got an enormous amount of money. They've been around for a very, very long time. And I think that their sole achievement as an organization of 25 years is, and it's a significant one, it's convincing the world that there was a liberal media bias, because that is what they do. And, it's one of those things that's impossible to disprove. I mean, if I say you're biased, Carl, as you just pointed out, I'm impugning, your thought process. I'm pretending that I know what your intentions are behind your words.
Well, and you don't even have to even try and prove it. I mean, and they never do. They just, scream it from the rooftops.
They just scream it. And I think that I feel like, I had thought for a while that maybe perhaps the media had grown wise to this. What I found really, apparently not. What I found, the things that jumped out at me from this are that one, you're talking, Mitt Romney is a candidate that Howard Kurtz admits in this write-up on this study.
Right.
He's a media-shy candidate, and he keeps his distance from the media. So he gets a lot of his coverage from Fox News. That's where he interacts with the media. And I'm disappointed to see that the mainstream media, over an extremely long period of time, I mean, we're talking January to April 15th, that's a very, very long period to do this kind of an analysis over.
Well, and I think that I don't think Mitt Romney's been on any of the all-important Sunday shows or sat down for any real interviews with anybody outside the conservative media in quite some time.
No, he's rewarded for it
right, with
good coverage. Twice as good as the president who, let's face it, the president, look, a lot of this, it's all really the same dynamics. The president is getting caught up in situational, you know, in situational dynamics, you know, fights over, you know, gas prices, Republican led challenges to the healthcare bill that was passed into law 2 years ago. And as they are now challenging in the courts, and then that leads to negative media coverage of President Obama, whereas, you know, Mitt Romney just doesn't engage and he gets good coverage.
And let's look at the types of issues that the media aren't, you know, demanding more from Mitt Romney on. If we could hit one of these clips, Jacob, let's hit clip number 5.
When will you release your tax returns specifically?
When they're completed this year in April, I'll release my returns in April and probably for other years as well.
So, yeah, that was during those debates, and he's filed for an extension, which would give him until October. We've got like a minute left, Eric. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's ridiculous. I think that the media should be hammering him on this when he is running as a businessman, when we know that he's extremely wealthy. I mean, this is a guy when Barack Obama, the president, said Mitt Romney was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth. You know, Mitt Romney found a way to take umbrage to that and proclaim that he was a victim and that the president was insulting his father and attacking Americans. It's
ridiculous. Perhaps the reason that they're not releasing his taxes, it looks like, until October now is because of how embarrassing it was the first time around when they put out some numbers. Eric Burns, my business partner, Bullfight Strategies, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Carl.
Absolutely. We'll be back with Eric tomorrow as well. More great Tom Hartman program after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, investigative reporter Lee Fong from the Republic Report.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I am Carl Frisch. Got a great show for you this afternoon. Let's take some of your calls. Let's talk to Daryl in Denver. Hey, Daryl.
Hey, Carl. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Hey, you know, you're talking about Newt, but you're, like the rest of the mainstream media, you're ignoring Ron Paul, which is he's doing pretty well in the caucus states, actually.
No, he's not. He's not doing well in the caucus states. Ron Paul's campaign is as pathetic as Newt Gingrich's at this point.
Ron Paul won Minnesota. He's going to win Colorado.
Uh-huh.
He'll probably win Missouri and a few other states as far as delegates go.
And he'll walk in with how many delegates?
Well, we'll see how the final vote goes.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Don't let your delusion get you in a car accident there. Have a good one. There are still Paul people out there, obviously. He had a big rally, I think, in Missouri the other day. I just wish somebody would explain to people there that he is never going to be the Republican nominee. He will never be president of the United States. But I would really love it if he would run for the Libertarian nomination for president. I think he'd be a great candidate for Libertarian nomination for president, and he'd probably siphon off a good percentage of votes from Mitt Romney. But there are other issues I want to talk about as well. So, speaking of Newt Gingrich, you've got, some of the things that he stood for are not dying, even though his campaign is basically dead on arrival. You may recall months ago when he suggested that perhaps we should let children work as janitors. But did you know that there is special interest in Washington lobbying to make it, easier for children to work in agricultural jobs? Joining me now to talk about this and other issues is Lee Fong. He's an investigative reporter with the United Republic's Republic Report. Lee, thanks for joining me. Lee, are you there? Lee?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. So you've got the agriculture industry, which is obviously extremely influential in Washington. They've got hordes of lawyers and lots of members of Congress that represent districts that rely on agriculture as the economic base of jobs. You've got this piece that you wrote, posted it today, that talks about how they've been lobbying to keep the Obama administration from making it more difficult for child labor in this country.
Yeah, that's right, Carl. These rules, these anti-child labor rules, were long delayed, and they were released to the public last year. Basically, the Department of Labor is updating, you know, very old regulations prohibiting children from using heavy machinery or working in very hazardous conditions on farms. Child labor is still even an issue here in the United States with kids as young as 14 using very dangerous machinery. You know, in some cases, they've hurt themselves. Kids have died or, you know, lost hands, fingers, or even legs.
Yeah, you write about this Zaldewick Grain Company in Oklahoma, where two children who were working on a, I guess, a big auger, a grain auger, lost their legs.
Yeah, that's right. And the Department of Labor put out these updated rules preventing children from working in these types of conditions. And predictably, the big ag industry has fought back very aggressively, and they've used some of their biggest supporters in Congress to beat back the Obama administration. First, Congressman Denny Rayburg, the congressman from Montana, now running for Senate, so he needs a lot of campaign cash, but he's been their go-to person on this issue. He circulated a letter last year attacking the Department of Labor, and now we have Senator Thune from South Dakota actually introducing legislation that would make these regulations impossible to enact from the Department of Labor.
So, I mean, at what point do we acknowledge that that the Republican Party is trying to take us not back to the 1950s, but back to the turn of the century?
Well, you know, I think when we had the Citizens United decision, which repealed 100 years of campaign finance law, it shouldn't be surprising that our other laws, our other
right.
public policy that governs our country is going to start reverting back as well. With big money corrupts the system, and this covers every issue area, even labor law.
Well, not, I mean, yeah, I'm thinking of birth control, I'm thinking of choice, I'm thinking of all these things that we've probably taken for granted. I mean, one of the reasons that we have this manufacturing crisis in this country is because we've shipped all of these jobs overseas to China, where young people work upwards, you know, in some cases upwards of 18-hour days to make the products that we all love here in America. And the argument being that that's why they're so cheap and blah, 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 blah. But then you find out that we've got young people working on farms in dangerous situations here at home.
That's right. And, you know, it's not even 100 years of rules and regulations that they're rolling back. Republicans in Congress and, unfortunately, President Obama enacted the so-called Jobs Act just last week, which basically rolls back Sarbanes-Oxley for small-cap companies, basically deregulating a huge portion of Wall Street. So it's a problem across the board. And Obama, his hands were tied because, you know, big lobbyists from the tech industry to Wall Street forced his hand on this. So it's an attack from all sides.
Well, what's being done to make this right? Anything?
On the child labor issue, it's looking pretty bad because, you know, the big ag industry has a lot of campaign contributions. They have some Democrats supporting them, lots of Republicans. And the legislation that would stop the Department of Labor from implementing these child labor rules is moving right ahead on schedule. So I think you'll see it passed by Congress in just the next few months. And basically, Obama will be either forced to sign it or it'll be slipped into one of those appropriation bills.
Well, I hesitate to say that the industry doesn't have a leg to stand on because I don't want to seem crass and unthoughtful to the people that have been injured, the young people that have been injured while working on these farms. But at some point, we have to ask ourselves what the heck we're doing. Lee, you've also got this piece, People Remember SOPA, that was the Stop Online Piracy Act, the big attempt by the recording industry in Hollywood and entertainment folks to, in their words, crack down on pirating, but in reality make it impossible, basically, to use the Internet for any creative purpose. And now it looks like they're going at it from a different direction.
Yep.
Tell us about, is it called CISPA?
Yes, CISPA, new legislation, you know, euphemistically called, you know, Cyber Information Sharing Protection Act or something, you know. But the important thing for people to know is that this law does two things. First, it makes an unprecedented move to shift a lot of the cybersecurity responsibilities from civilian authorities like police agencies to military authorities like the NSA, the CIA, and that sort of thing. The other thing that this law does, it provides broad language for internet service providers to share information about their own customers, you know, people who use the internet like you and me, with the government. So you've got a collusion of big corporations and big government to increase spying power. And, you know, they have very vague terms. They say, you know, any cybersecurity threat. Well, what does that mean? Is that a copyright right. violation? Is that someone who's linking to WikiLeaks? Is that someone who's just, you know, talking about some kind of a sensitive leak from the government, or like a whistleblower? It's so vaguely defined. It could be abused or used in any way.
Well, it reminds me of what we went through with the phone companies after 9/11. Where, you know, the phone companies had been giving over information to the government, and then they were basically, it was basically made so that we couldn't sue the phone companies, for doing that. It sounds like they're basically, you know, going out there and giving these internet service providers carte blanche and saying, let's put this into law right now so that we can do whatever we want and not, you know, we won't have to put you in a position of being in trouble like the phone companies were.
Yeah, I think that's right, Carl. And, you know, there's another parallel that we point out at republicreport.org. Back then, when they were lobbying for blanket immunity for these phone companies, those phone companies were actually going to Congress and hiring lots of lobbyists to pass that law because, of course, they didn't want liability. They didn't want to get sued. Well, for this legislation, CITSFA, look at the lobbying registrations, which came out just in the last week. Look who's spending big bucks to pass this bill. It's internet service providers because, they want to move out of that legal gray area and be in the clear. But it's also for-profit data mining corporations that work with the NSA. They're companies like CSC, Computer Sciences Corporation. They have these big multi-billion-dollar contracts with the NSA.
They probably get a lot more business if this goes through.
Yeah, you would think so.
Where's the outrage? I mean, you couldn't go anywhere on the internet without seeing something about SOPA. You couldn't go anywhere eventually on television and the radio without hearing something about SOPA. You don't hear about this. Why not?
Well, here's the big difference.
We've got about a minute left.
What was horrible because it cracked down on both content providers and regular consumers. Well, CISPA is different because it mostly focuses only on consumers. So now you don't have Google, Facebook, and everyone getting angry about this bill. They're actually working with the government, with CSC, and the consumer.
So comparing the two is a bit like the consumer will scratch the industry's back, and the industry will just turn our backs when it's all on the consumers. Lee Fong of the Republic Report, thanks for joining me today. You can follow Lee at LH Fong on Twitter. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is tragic what we do in the poorest neighborhoods in trapping children, in child laws, which are truly stupid.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. We've got Mike in Chicago, Illinois, who is at the heart of a protest against the Ryan budget, or as I've come to call it, the Hunger Games. Where Noah Wiley and 25 people or more have been arrested. Mike, how are you?
Hey, nice word for it, the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I'll have to remember that one.
So what's going on out there?
Well, I'm in the Hart office building in the Senate office building in Washington, but earlier today I'm with a group called ADAPT, American Disabled Veteran Protest. We do civil disobedience type protests, and we were in the rotunda of the Senate office building chanting really loudly and disrupting things in protest of Paul Ryan's budget. Actor Noah Wiley joined us for our action. We're here for 4 days in Washington doing actions, and he was one of 125 people that were arrested by the Capitol Police as part of this protest. We're very upset because people with disabilities rely very heavily on Medicaid.
Sure.
And for the second year in a row, Ryan has proposed cuts that. I mean, I just, that are so devastating, it's hard to even begin to talk about them. So we really can't even think of this going through. So we just immediately spring into action, and that's what our group did. And about, I'd say at least half the people that were arrested were people with disabilities, most of them in wheelchairs.
Yeah, I don't even know why we give credit to Paul Ryan for, you know, working on budgets. At this point, everybody needs to know that this guy got started in politics as a right-wing social issues activist. He doesn't have, experience with the budgeting process. And perhaps that's why his budgets look callous and heartless. If people want to know why we talk about the Republican war on the middle class, the Republican war on women, it's because of things like this. And Mike's right. It's not just the attacks on Medicaid, but it's Medicare. It's Social Security. It's leaving all of these things up for jeopardy. It's food stamps, putting food on American, working families' tables, or in the words of George Bush, it's hard to put food on your family. And Ryan would make it even more difficult on just a bunch of different grounds. We've got Armin in Brandelton, Florida. Armin.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well.
So, I was watching Fox today.
I'm sorry.
Well, when I say watching, it's like when you're possibly in a neighborhood that you're not too sure is safe, you watch over your back, don't you?
Sure, okay.
So wouldn't I be watching Fox that way?
Yeah, what did you see on Fox that caught your eye?
Supposedly, I didn't see this, but somebody else told me that they were watching it, and supposedly Fox has a new poll that the majority of the respondents that compiled the poll said that they think the rich should be able to steal more and pay less in taxes.
Absolutely. I bet the Fox News people did vote that way. I guarantee you, though, the poll that they're talking about is, it was probably like Lou Dobbs or Bill O'Reilly telling their people, go to foxnews.com and vote in the online poll. And you know what? Whenever their crazy audience does vote in those polls, they always do it in a way that defies logic and reality. It never quite lines up with the way the American people would react to a question like that. Everybody knows that 60 to 70% of Republicans agree that the extremely wealthy in this country should be asked to join us all in sacrificing and paying a bit more. The bottom, middle class, the working class in this country has been sacrificing like mad. And there's one group of people who haven't been forced to sacrifice. It's the Mitt Romneys of the world. They've been able to play with their triage horses or whatever they're called, their little fancy dancing horses, while the rest of us have been worried about putting food on the table, whether or not our kids are going to be able to get a job when they get out of college. And now people like Paul Ryan want to push their Hunger Games strategy and basically ask the working people of this country to sacrifice even more. It's sick and it's immoral. Budgets are all about morality at the end of the day. It's a blueprint that explains where your values are, and that's exactly what the budget plan does. Kevin in Palm Springs.
Hey, how you doing, Carl?
I'm great, Kevin. How are you?
Well,
we got to make
what?
It quick.
We fought this back, like I said, to your screener. I'm an old punk rocker, man. We fought this years back.
Right.
In 82. I mean, we...
Oh, we've lost. I mean, Reaganomics has won. For 30 years, we've been dealing with the aftermath of Reaganomics.
Yeah. Now, finally, it's the blowback.
Right.
Kind of, so to speak, with it. And it's finally happening. It makes me happy. Only because, I'm a father, of course.
Right.
And but it's just insane the way things have been let go for so long.
Well, and do you find this funny at all, Kevin? You mentioned, you're a punk rocker. You've been involved all these years. Ronald Reagan wouldn't even be allowed into the Republican Party these days. He's not conservative enough.
And we boycotted him. We sat there and I was in riots over him.
Right. Well, and today, Ronald Reagan, who raised taxes 11 times, who negotiated with terrorists in Tehran, Iran, who left Marines to die, who gave amnesty to illegals, to undocumented immigrants, who signed pro-choice legislation as governor of California, would be laughed out of the Republican Party today. He could not be the nominee. And yet you've got these Republicans wandering around in the desert looking for their next Ronald Reagan, and they've landed on Mitt Romney. About the only thing they have in common, Ronald Reagan and Mitt Romney, is impeccable hair and very classy wives. And that's about it. And, you know, about the time the Republican Party realizes that there is no Ronald Reagan out there in the wilderness, because Ronald Reagan would never be allowed in their party today, is about the time they'll get their act together and start doing things that, are not just better for the future of their own party, but better for the future of this country. So it's 57 before the bottom of the hour. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be back in just a bit. Stick around.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. I am Carl Frisch. If you want to give Tom and Louise your kind thoughts, words, and prayers, go to the website, tomhartman.com. Go to the message board, and you can do so there. Louise is recovering from surgery she had this morning. You can leave your thoughts there. They will be reading it. So go ahead and do that, tomhartman.com. If you're just joining us, we have a great show lined up. You know, one of the things that has occurred to me over the years is that the Republican Party is making it harder and harder for people to succeed in this country. And one of my favorite guests to bring on the show to talk about this kind of stuff and just about anything out there is Tina Dupuy. She's a good friend of mine. She's also the managing editor of crooksandliars.com. You can find her syndicated column at tinadupuy.com. That's D-U-P-U-Y.com. She's also on Twitter at the same name, at Tina Dupuy. Hello, Tina.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm well. So tell me about this paradox of upward mobility in America.
Well, countries with less equality generally have less mobility. So you have countries with this extreme wealth inequality where, let's say, the 1% of citizens make the majority of the money, have the majority of the assets, pretty much own everything. It is harder for one to start out in the lower or less likely to start off in the lower classes and move up to, say, the middle class, or be born middle class and move up to the upper middle class. And what we've seen in our country over the last 30 years of very influential Republican policy has not actually trickled down. We've had a flattening of middle class wages, a flattening of worker wages. Everything's now more expensive than it used to be, and you know, but we're not making any more money. So we are no longer able to really be upwardly mobile, which was, you know, always the kind of that's always been the American dream.
Right.
You can start off with nothing, pull yourself up by your bootstraps,
do better than your parents' generation, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. But the paradox is, we have you know, I'm moving, so I started to think about this. You know, I have a phone that basically is a mini computer. I can take everything that I own, as far as media, all my MP3s, all my DVDs, everything is on a cloud somewhere, and I can basically go anywhere, just not into the upper middle class.
Right. Oh, that's so sad. So, and do you think that's one of the reasons that you've got these things like the Occupy movement and these other, you know, folks getting excited about the discussion over income inequality, is because this is becoming more and more blatant to the eye?
Well, yeah, I mean, for years, you know, you and I had this discussion all the time. We were like, why aren't people, you know, out on the street marching about this stuff? And suddenly, last fall, people were out on the street marching about this stuff.
Right.
You know, and yeah, it's gotten to the point where there, you know, it passed a tipping point where, you know, now it, and the students, this is really coming to the forefront this week. Students are the ones who are really paying the price for this.
Absolutely.
We, you know, as we're focused on the older generation, the baby boomers who are still, you know, who are now retiring, they are still the biggest generation, but you have their children, who are not able to go to college and not be debt slaves for the rest of their life. I mean, I've talked to kids in the Occupy camps who were, you know, $100,000, $200,000.
And that's cheap.
Surprisingly, not hard to do. And we're talking about people who have a 30% APR. They'll never be able to buy a home. They'll never be able to do anything other than pay off their student loans. And, you know, and the kicker is they can't find a job for more than $10 an hour after they graduate with all those loans.
Well, and, you know, so, yeah, some of those $100,000, $200,000, burdens are from public universities too.
Right, exactly. There's no Ivy League education to go along with that price tag. So yeah, it's gotten to be, you know, where it's no longer.
And with the weak economy, I mean, the thing that's so sad with the weak economy, so many young people are being told, okay, go get your master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
That'll make you more acceptable and more palatable to the job environment. And what it really does at the same time is just adds even more debt and more burden to these young people.
Exactly, and that was always the ticket out, to upward mobility, was to get an education, to get a better education than your parents had, to get a higher education than your parents had, and that was your ticket in order to move up. And that's actually the opposite is now more likely, because if you have to pay for that with student loans or any kind of debt that is not negotiable ever and will not go away if you declare bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, and these are
for people that don't know, student loans are the only type of debt that I'm aware of that you cannot get rid of in bankruptcy.
Right. And that was something that, you know, was legislation that had gone through Congress. I mean, there is a very, you know, talk about a conspiracy, like this was, you know, this has been, decades coming. And then the state governments have gone in and made all these drastic cuts to state education to make tuitions higher and higher and higher. So college is just not a financially viable pursuit anymore for a lot of people, which is incredibly disappointing.
And when you have a weak job market, it just makes people think that they need to do it even more. It really is a vicious cycle. Meanwhile, you've got Republicans standing up for these horrible for-profit colleges. This industry that is ballooning I'm convinced that one of the reasons that we're now approaching $1 trillion in student loan debt in this country, which is more than the credit card debt in this country for the first time ever, is because so many people are being duped into taking out these loans for meaningless certificates and worthless degrees at these for-profit colleges, places like Phoenix and DeVry and other places like that, which end up being worthless. I mean, you read stories about people who get a nurse's license from some, for-profit institution, and then when they go home to the state that they came from, that their license isn't good enough to pass the muster of where they're from. And they wasted, twice what they would have spent at the junior college on that certificate going to a for-profit college.
And they have no resource as a consumer. You can't go back and get your money back if your certificate that you just paid for that you earned allegedly is not good. So, I mean, there's no consumer protection. There's no debt protection. You know, it's really insidious. And it's been something that, is now, has gotten worse and worse and has reached a tipping point.
Well, and, these for-profit colleges. What's that?
This is the free market.
Right, yeah, it's the free market, except that these for-profit colleges, places like Phoenix, et cetera, Kaplan, DeVry, they are allowed to make 9 out of every $10 from federal funds. And so they do make 9 out of every $10 from federal funds. I think the average is like in the high 80s to low, to upwards of 90%. And that's in Department of Education dollars. But did you know that because of the Department of Defense's program, the new GI Bill, that money doesn't count as education dollars. So they're capable of they are literally capable today of making all of their money from federal dollars And that's the free market, Tina.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a lot like Walmart, how we subsidize their workforce because they can't pay or won't pay or don't pay their workers a living wage. We pay for their food stamps.
And we're actually,
and so
they're
we
actually
feed Walmart
encouraged.
Workers. We feed and sometimes, you know, pay for, you know, pay for their Medicare, medical expenses.
Right.
Because Walmart can have those low.
And
low
Walmart
prices.
Encourages their employees to go
yes,
get that
absolutely.
Assistance. It's crazy. Because they know that
so
if the workers are healthier, if the workers are healthier, they'll show up for work. So why not just put them on the government dole instead of doing it themselves? Tina, can you stick around? I want to talk about the Republican war on religion as well.
Of course.
All right. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back with more from Tina Dupuy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Republicans didn't set out for a war on women. They wanted a war on religion. Up next.
Monday.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Tina Dupuy. She is a syndicated columnist and the managing editor of Crooks and Liars, crooksandliars.com. You can find Tina on Twitter at Tina Dupuy. You can also find her online at tinadupuy.com. Hello, Tina. How are you?
I'm good, Carl.
So we've got a couple calls I want to get to that have some thoughts. Let's take Clifford in Carroll, Texas. Hello, Clifford.
Hi. Glad to hear you. Okay. I've got 2 points. They're basically comments / questions. One is, why do jobs, this is something the government can lead the way in, why do jobs that are essentially clerical in nature require you to have a degree? And the second point is, to cut college costs, why? I'll give you an example. Law school and medical school, is there any reason that can justify them requiring you to have a bachelor's degree before you get into their school? Let you take the entrance exam. I don't care what your background is. And if you pass the entrance exam...
Yeah, I can't speak to a lot of the policy questions related to that. Tina, do you have any thoughts?
You just dropped me, so I didn't hear any of the questions.
Well, he had some questions about why do people have to go to get a undergrad degree when they want to go to law school. I mean, I know that you can go to graduate school without getting a bachelor's degree. It's just not commonly done. You know, part of the reason is that people need to look like they're well-prepared for the level of learning that they're about to embark on. You never know. Let's see here. What about John in Chicago? John?
Hi, guys. I was just this may not be, like, the answer for some people, but my wife is doing a government job working with the Department of National Resources. She's currently on her last semester to get her master's for that, and she's going to end up with a little over $60,000 in student loans. And the deal that they have going for her, I'm not sure if it's a fellowship or anything, that if she works with them for about 10 years, that they will, and she would pay the rest of the student loan while she's working with them for 10 years, but at the end of the 10 years, they'll write it off. So that could be the answer for some people out there.
They have the same programs if you work in the House or in the Senate, but not everybody's that fortunate, and not everybody qualifies for those programs. So, Tina, isn't this really about fixing the problem at its heart instead of trying to find ways to, you know, fiddle around the edges?
Well, it's also the way we think of higher education. I mean, this is the public interest. This is our future that we are investing in. If other countries are beating us in engineers and scientists and all those other, you know, very important jobs, you know, that is not okay. That's not planning for the future of our country. And so we need to start looking at and also having a debt slave who also has a really has a useful degree is also not good for our country. That's
right.
Someone who will never buy a car, who will never buy a home, who will not be able to have children. I mean, it's, you know, you can't live in, you can't call yourself a free citizen if you have $100,000 worth of debt and no house to show for it. So, you know, we need to start looking at, you know, having the long game in mind and know that, you know, college is a public interest venture, and it's just as important as roads or any other infrastructure. We need people educated. We need them to be literate, and, you know, be educated. I mean, it's, that's why we have public education in the first place.
Well, actually, I think we have public
to our founding fathers.
I don't want to blow the lid here, but I think we have public education so that we can brainwash people into being liberal.
Right.
I mean,
but, our founding fathers were very into public education. That was, you know, we were some of the most literate people on the planet. It wasn't the pilgrims that came over here that wrote the Constitution. The colonists were some of the most highly educated and literate people on the planet at that time. I mean, the reason why we speak English now is because we were obsessed with English books. That
right.
We were importing from the old world. So, you know, I mean, we have this kind of, and we've lost our way when it comes to how we look at public education.
Speaking of losing our way, the Republicans have lost their way over the last year. You write that the Republicans didn't set out to have a war on women. It was really what they were trying to do was start a war on religion.
Oh, they botched this one good. It was great. It's been so much fun. Yeah, the word slut kind of just ruined this whole war on religion. You know, it was very well calculated. You know, if you were watching as I was, you have they decided that this mandate for birth control to be covered by insurance, and that was
right.
The thing
by
since
insurance,
Viagra.
Right?
Right. Since Viagra was invented, it was always like, okay, well, insurance will pay for Viagra, but not for birth control.
Right.
And Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, righted that, and so
even though women need birth control for a variety of reasons. Notwithstanding.
You got it. And also for controlling birth.
Right.
Which is a legitimate reason
sure.
as acne or any other medical reason. And it's also, you know, none of your business. Unless you're a Republican, then it is quite your business.
Well, Viagra has many uses as well, I'm told.
You are? Then you've been lied to.
Yeah. I one of them might last in 4 hours, call a doctor.
Right. Nothing more than jokes, is Viagra good for. So they set out, they were like, this isn't about, you know, birth control. This is about religious freedom. And so they had, you know, of course, Daryl Issa had this panel of religious men saying how they would be affected if birth control were covered by private insurance. And, you know, and it was this kind of very coordinated effort to, beat the war drum to have this, they wanted a war on religion, because if they had a war on religion, then everyone would just forget that Romney's a Mormon. And they could have a united front
right.
against Obama on the religious front.
Well, and they squandered that opportunity. Tina, we're going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate you coming on today. That's Tina Dupuy, syndicated columnist, managing editor of Crooks and Liars. Find her at tinadupuy.com, and that's D-U-P-U-Y. You can also find her on Twitter. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. It's 27 after the hour, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Immigration is heading to the Supreme Court. We'll be talking to Doug Kendall after this.
I know it's hard. No, it's hard to remember sometimes. But you gotta keep your head up. Oh, and you can let your head down.
All right, it wasn't that long ago, friends. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. It wasn't that long ago that we saw Jan Brewer, the feisty governor of Arizona, waving her finger in the face of the president of the United States, you know, to help sell some of her books. And really what it all comes down to is AB 1070, that's Assembly Bill 1070, that became law in Arizona. It's one of the most draconian, absolutely backwards immigration laws passed by a local government until, of course, Alabama took the lead of Arizona and did the similar work there. That law is now going to the Supreme Court. On Wednesday, the High Court will hear oral arguments for and against the immigration law in Arizona. And joining me now to talk about that is the founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which you can find at theusconstitution.org, Doug Kendall. Doug, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
So set it up for us. I mean, what exactly is being challenged here, and what are we likely to hear at the Supreme Court on Wednesday?
Sure. Well, so as you described, Arizona has passed a law that basically tries to take immigration enforcement away from the federal government and give it to the states. And so this is one of those areas where the founders of the United States decided in foreign policy areas and things about national security, the federal government needs to have the lead role. That's why the Constitution talks about a uniform policy of naturalization, and immigration laws under that rubric under the Constitution. And so Arizona has decided, you know what, we think we can do this better. We think we're going to strike the right balance. And so what they've done is basically passed a law that is now a model for some other conservative states, which says basically that we are going to make it a crime in Arizona to be an illegal alien. We're going to require police officers to check the immigration status of immigrants that they come into contact with.
Basically anybody, isn't it? Like, you can get a parking ticket or speeding ticket, rather, enrolling at schools, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, it certainly gives the police the authority to check the immigration status of anyone they think, anyone who's of Hispanic origin. And if the person doesn't have ID or something, they can arrest them and then bring them into the federal system. And so it really is the Congress has given the president a great deal of discretion to decide how exactly to enforce immigration policy. And so,
well, and this president, I mean, he has been gangbusters on the illegal immigration issue. I mean, more people have been deported.
Right.
More than George Bush ever did.
Right. He has not failed to secure the borders or to enforce the immigration laws that are on the books. That is entirely entirely wrong claim by folks on the right.
Well, and here's one of the things that always gets me about these phony constitutional conservatives. They always claim the 10th Amendment, and look, there are very specific things that the federal government, it spells out in the language of the Constitution, right there in black and white, that the federal government will be responsible for these three things. And one of those three things is immigration.
Right, right.
And yet it's the conservatives that are the ones pushing these crazy bills all over the place.
Well, and remember, too, that not that long ago, it was the Bush administration who was talking about the president being a unitary executive and
right.
having unlimited authority and unilateral authority to make foreign policy. And now those same people have just turned around and said, no, 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 the president has no authority. Obama
can't do
anything. But,
Doug, of course. I mean, the president's black now, so... they don't want to let him, run roughshod over the 10th Amendment rights of these states and localities.
The president is of a different party, certainly. That seems to have had an effect that it shouldn't in terms of constitutional discourse.
So, now the Supreme Court is going to be hearing this case. What do you expect to happen? I understand that you, as well as some others from your organization, the Constitutional Accountability Center, will be in attendance for the oral arguments on Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll be at the court on Wednesday. It's a little hard to predict how the court will view this case. We're hopeful at least that some of the provisions where Arizona really takes the law into their own hands, even the conservatives on the court will have some problems with what Arizona is doing, but it's certainly another one of these cases that is incredibly politically charged, just like the Affordable Care Act case. We hope that the court's conservatives will decide it according to the law, which should mean that the Obama administration will prevail in this case. As we saw in the Affordable Care Act case, there's more politics going on in the court
right.
than I think anybody would like there.
Well, and it's really unfortunate because on constitutional grounds, we win.
That's right. If you look, and there's a brief filed. We filed a brief in this case, laying out why the text and history of the Constitution so strongly supports the Obama administration here. There's also a really extraordinary brief filed by Department of State and Department of Defense officials from both political parties that says, look, this is an area where the federal government and the president has to have special authority. And I think if the court takes seriously that brief and our brief, there's really only one answer here.
which is the side with
which is that the Obama administration, right. You know, where it's weighing in, where it's saying that.
Well, not just the Obama administration, right? This is the future of.
Well, this is Congress.
The administrations in the future as well.
That's right. That's right. This is an interest that every president has. It's an interest that Congress has. I mean, Congress has given the Constitution, and Congress has given President Obama authority here.
Although Mitt Romney, should he become president, he's indicated that this would be a model of what he'd like to see replicated all over the country. And that's happened in some places like Alabama, where you've got this immigration law there, where you've had people being arrested that run, you know, German motor companies that happen to be building cars there because they didn't have the exact proper paperwork with them.
No, and I think that's one of the other things that people don't really realize is how much opposition there is to laws like this in the business community, who, you know, has, as you just said,
and not just because they're, you know, relying on cheap labor with undocumented
immigrants. In the, you know, if you have an executive from Mercedes-Benz who's in Georgia trying to open up a plant, I think the state has a pretty intense interest in not having him arrested and thrown into jail because he doesn't have the proper, because he doesn't have his passport with him. I think there's...
Even if it is unfortunate that it takes somebody that's German...
That's right.
To make, you know,
make that point.
These people see what they're doing. What do you expect the arguments to look like?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the case is that it's basically a replay of the players from the healthcare case. So it's Solicitor General Don Verrilli is arguing for the Obama administration. The former Solicitor General and now kind of the right wing's favorite lawyer, Paul Clement, is there arguing for Jan Brewer and Arizona. And so it'll be the same basic cast of characters that we saw for 3 days in the healthcare case. And that's another one of the reasons the case is drawing a lot of interest.
Well, it's certainly going to be something big. Do you anticipate, obviously, the final decision will be made or announced in June, right?
Yeah, no, it's the last case that will be argued this term. It's the last day that the Supreme Court will sit and hear oral arguments, so it's almost certain that it will be decided one of the last days of the term, which ends on it's scheduled to end on June 25th.
So we may not hear anything about this for quite some time. Do you anticipate that it'll get as much media traction? Are you seeing that out there?
Well,
the healthcare bill.
It's not as big a case as the healthcare case, principally because of the way the court is treating it. The healthcare case, the court scheduled 5.5 hours of argument over a 3-day period. They signaled by doing that they thought it was, you know, a momentous and huge case. They've just scheduled an hour of oral argument on this case.
And that's pretty standard.
Which is a standard amount of time. And so it is not getting as much attention, but
it's still an hour in which Clarence Thomas will say absolutely nothing, though.
That is right. I think that's, he's been silent on the court for, I believe, 6 years now, and I don't anticipate that changing on Wednesday.
We're talking to Doug Kendall. He's the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which you can find at the usconstitution.org. You're also the leader of Constitutional Progressives. I count myself among them. We chatted a couple weeks ago when the arguments were around healthcare. Now there's this new – the arguments before the Supreme Court were around healthcare. Now there's this story that's come out that says – let me just find it here really quick. Basically that the healthcare law that was put in place by the president and by Congress will end up saving buckets of money when it comes to Medicare. And I'd love to get your thoughts on it on the other side of the break, if you can stick around for a minute.
Sure.
All right. This is Doug Kendall from the Constitutional Accountability Center. So basically what the story says is that, because of the shaky economy, Social Security, Medicare, they're on rockier ground than was previously thought. But with the changes to the law that the Affordable Care Act brings in, that over time, hundreds of billions of dollars will be saved, and it strengthens the programs as a whole. So we'll talk about that when we come back after this break with Doug Kendall. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more on the fate of Obamacare.
Life's too short to even care at all.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. That's one of my favorite songs right now, actually. But if you're just joining us, we're talking to Doug Kendall. He is the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Doug, thanks for sticking around.
Sure.
So I was saying before the break that there's this report out. The CMS expects the 2010 healthcare reform law to yield more than $200 billion in savings through 2016. That's only, you know, 4 short years. Because of measures that include ending excessive payments to private insurers that other Medicare Advantage plans and implementing new anti-fraud policies. Do these types of reports help with the deliberations going on between the justices now? Impact them at all?
Right. I think it's probably not is the answer.
Yeah.
I think that the court has already made its decision and they're just writing the opinion at this point. I think it would be very hard to imagine any particular justice reading something in USA Today and deciding, wait a second, I made the wrong decision.
But I do think that it were true.
I do think, though, that it the report highlights that there is, in this bill, just in this law, just a tremendous amount of things that improve the healthcare system in this country and work towards things that just about every American wants, which is better care for less money. And that's what this report highlights is are parts of this law that have gotten no attention.
And those point to the constitutionality of the measure. I mean,
right.
We're talking about a widespread national problem and a national solution that looks like it will actually impact the problem.
Right. No, that's exactly right. The healthcare industry is about a fifth of the United States economy. It is a huge portion of the national economy, and this law addresses a genuine crisis. That is exactly what the Constitution was established to allow the federal government to do. And I think the scariest thing about the arguments last month was the possibility that the conservatives were raising of striking down the entire 2,700-page Affordable Care Act, which includes all sorts of provisions that, you know, across the gamut of things, which just are
pre-existing conditions.
Pre-existing conditions, but also things like this, which are these cost-saving measures that, again, everybody is in favor of and everybody recognizes needs to be done. And so the idea that you would get, throw the baby out with the bathwater or whatever you want, whatever analogy you want to use, the fact that you would just get rid of this entire act that took 2 years of congressional time to get through and is clearly constitutional in the vast majority of its parts is just both scary and it just illustrates that, you know, the Constitution is at a crossroads in this country. And it's not just on this issue, it's on immigration, it's on voting rights. Across the board, there is this really disturbing 5-4 ideological split on the court that every one of your listeners and everyone across the country should be minding to, because the different visions of the Tea Party and progressives about what our Constitution means is an incredibly important debate. And I think, I mean, that's why we launched Constitutional Progressives in the fall of 2011. That's why, you know, we progressives need to be fighting for our vision of a Constitution that protects things like voting rights and individual rights.
Well, and whenever we talk about these issues, whenever we talk about the health care reform bill, the Affordable Care Act, we should be talking about it in terms of the Constitution, because when we don't, the perception builds that it's not constitutional, and that couldn't be further from the truth.
No, that's exactly right, Carl. I mean, that there's polling that shows that even a majority of supporters of the Affordable Care Act have been convinced that it's unconstitutional. Well, that is crazy. It's crazy because, you know, the text in history could hardly be more clear that the federal government was designed to have the power to address national problems. It is uncontroversial that the healthcare crisis is a national problem that crosses state lines. And so the idea that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this is a pretty fringe idea. And yet the right has messaged on this so hard, so consistently, that they have convinced people, even supporters of the act,
right,
that it's unconstitutional. That's crazy, and it shows how much work we have to do to take back the Constitution and its text and history.
Yeah, I would say that the Constitution has a well-known, verifiable liberal bias. But that's just me. I'm a firm believer that we need to wake up in this country and identify as constitutional progressives. We need to be winning, not just – I get the point behind the talking points that folks across the progressive community are using on this issue. We've been told by spinmeisters that we need to – engage emotionally and everything else, but we need to engage on the substance as well.
Right.
Yes, these programs and these changes are popular, and they're meant to address serious problems that affect real people, but they're also 100% constitutional.
Right. You can't just win an argument about results and about the impact of the law. You have to, in America,
because what
win
happens,
an argument about the Constitution.
Happens if it gets struck down and we don't have the constitutional argument on our side?
No, that's right. We have to be able to marshal and win an argument about the constitutionality of it. And the document and its history totally support us, but we have to get that argument out.
Because if they strike it down, how do we turn to the members of our community and say, hey, they struck it down, when they're just going to say, yeah, I liked it, but it was unconstitutional?
Right. No, that's what that polling, that's the danger of that poll, that shows that even the supporters think, have been convinced about the unconstitutionality of the individual mandate. We can't let that happen. And we can't, and we've let it happen. It's not an argument that we couldn't win. It's an argument we chose not to fight very hard and therefore haven't won.
Right.
And so it's something that you can't in this country just let the other side have the Constitution. It's the one document that everyone revers. And the genius of the right has been to,
Just hammer the issue
hammer
relentlessly.
The issue. Yeah.
Doug Kendall, he is the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Go join the Constitutional Progressives at constitutionalprogressives.org so that you can stay up to date on these important issues and fight for the Constitution and its progressive history. 57 at the bottom of the hour. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. It is 6 after the hour. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Find me on Facebook, YouTube, every other website you can possibly imagine. There's been this effort out there by LGBT activists to hold cable companies accountable for the anti-gay fearmongers that they bring on their air to talk about issues of LGBT equality. And one of the people they bring on regularly is Tony Perkins. And we've got this crazy story to tell you about today. Did you know that Mike and Ike were getting a divorce? The candy were getting a divorce? It's part of a new marketing campaign that's being done by the candy manufacturer. And now I've got this clip for you to hear. Let's go ahead and play it.
These days, you can't get a sugar high without experiencing a cultural low. Hello, I'm Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council in Washington. There's trouble in Candyland. After more than 70 years together, Mike and Ike are calling it quits. The duo is staging a gay divorce as part of a new ad campaign to draw in younger customers. In this society, even candy has an agenda. From Facebook to Tumblr, the Fruity Pear says, "The rumors are true. We just couldn't agree on stuff anymore."
Seriously, Tony Perkins. I think that Tony Perkins and people like Tony Perkins think about being gay more than I do, and I'm a gay man. It shouldn't be the case. But that's Tony Perkins, and obviously obsessed with Mike and Ike. and the pending divorce there. Joining me now to talk about this and more important pressing issues when it comes to LGBT equality is Sarah Warbelow. She is the state legislative director for the Human Rights Campaign. Sarah, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
So what do you make of this craziness that's being spewed by Tony Perkins and his ilk?
Oh, I think it's completely comedic. He has actually done more to draw attention to this ad campaign than
right.
probably ever would have received on its own. Clearly, it's intended to be released to a very limited audience, and it's just quite silly.
Well, and the candy manufacturer wasn't even billing it as a gay divorce. They didn't even sexualize the characters, Mike Reich, at all.
No, of course not. You know, and appealing to young people, I think we've got to be cautious there, too. I mean, who they're attempting to appeal to is people in their late teens and early 20s with all of this, certainly not kids who are 7 or 8.
Right. But it does show just how insidious the thinking of people like Tony Perkins is, that they see some gay agenda or the gay threat behind every corner.
Absolutely. I mean, he's clearly obsessed with sex, and particularly sex that he's not having.
Right.
And so it's just not exactly a healthy mindset for viewing what is sort of an innocent decision by a candy company.
Well, I recall the jokes of people imitating people like Tony Perkins saying things like, you know, these sinners participate in a deliciously decadent lifestyle that, you know, nobody else should be a part of. Anyways, I actually wanted you on the show because there are actually more important things to chat about than Tony Perkins' obsessions with the sex lives of millions of gay men and lesbian women. Missouri is advancing a so-called Don't Say Gay bill in its legislature. This is kind of similar to what happened in Tennessee, where they didn't want anybody from, you know, teachers to administrators to be able to use the word gay in the classroom or to acknowledge even the existence of gay people.
That's right. I mean, it's an absolute silencing of the entire school community on issues dealing with sexual orientation.
Including bullying. I mean, isn't that what this is really all about? It's so that if a kid is being bullied because of their perceived sexuality, and let's be honest, a lot of little boys and little girls are picked on because of the way that their sexuality is perceived, even as little kids, by other little kids, that a teacher can't step up and say, leave so-and-so alone, how they are is just fine.
Absolutely. You know, the teacher can step in and certainly prohibit name-calling or if it becomes physical violence. But what's really difficult and presents a challenge is they can't explain to the child perpetrating the bullying why what they did was unacceptable or wrong.
Right.
And what we're finding is when we talk with teachers, they're so uncomfortable with the idea of a don't say gay policy that they're saying, I don't even know if I could step in that circumstance.
Right. And what's the likelihood of this, you know, getting past the governor in Missouri?
You know, I think that's really up in the air right now. It's just recently been introduced into the legislature, and it's important that both the legislators and the governor hear from people, both students, parents, teachers,
allies,
people who used to be students.
Sure.
You know, everyone who has an opportunity to say, here is the effect of this particular piece of legislation. It may not have been what you intended, and it could make life much worse for
students. Well, and it's kind of, this was the seed that grew the tree. You're now seeing states that are considering legislation that would protect certain students from being held responsible for bullying children as long as they were able to couch it with their religious beliefs.
That's right. And we're seeing this, you know, sort of in two different ways. One was a bill in which luckily the most damaging piece was stripped out in Michigan that sort of explicitly said there was a license to bully for religious students. And in another state, some of the legislation that's passed or been proposed doesn't even explicitly address bullying, but it's set up in such a way that religious students get a free pass to say whatever they want, even if what they're saying is damaging to other students.
Right. And, of course, nobody's saying that the opposite should be true, you know, you should be able to pick on kids that are religious just because they're religious if you don't agree with them. This is about respect for everybody.
Absolutely. And the best bullying bills that are out there, anti-bullying bills, I should say, that are out there include protections for both LGBT students and religious students.
Right. So how much of this is just playing into the broader narrative that the right, the right-wing evangelical, so-called Christians, have been pushing, that they are the ones that are being bullied, they're the ones that are under attack?
It's all part of the same mindset. And I will say, you know, shockingly, I think that a lot of the legislators that are pushing these types of bills have really bought into it. You know, they've kind of drunk the proverbial Kool-Aid on it. They're convinced that they are under attack, which makes it really difficult to engage in a rational discussion about what students are truly experiencing in schools. And it's hard to show them that it's the LGBT kids who are experiencing the bullying and kids who are perceived to be LGBT.
Well, it's just so fascinating because if you think about it, let's say, take marriage equality, for example. The argument is that these Christian fundamentalists are under attack, that we're trying to push our morality and our marriages on them, when the opposite is actually true. I mean, if you think about it, the only marriage in most states that's open to LGBT people are straight marriages. So in reality, it's them pushing their religious beliefs on us, not the other way around, right?
Absolutely. You know, we've long made the argument that marriage equality is a form of religious freedom, that there are many churches and denominations,
sure,
who want to be able to marry same-sex couples. And if we're really talking about the freedom to practice one's religion, it needs to be freedom for all religions.
I certainly wish that was the case. We've been talking with our friend Sarah Warblow. She is the state legislative director at the Human Rights Campaign, which you can find at hrc.org. Sarah, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's 15 after. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're taking your calls, 866-987-8466. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, 20 after the hour. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Let's take Harold in Chicago. Hey, Harold.
Yes. People who are pushing all these anti-gay measures and don't say gay, so it's illegal to say gay in school, it's illegal to everything else. And Tony Perkins with his asinine comments and sickening stuff. These are the same people people who follow them are the same people that are duped. Violently saying or vigorously saying, no Sharia law, no Sharia law,
right.
No Sharia law.
Meanwhile.
It's being imposed on them in the name of anti-gay legislation.
Right. And, well, what's crazy is that this is just so relentless, and how much culture has moved away from them. You mentioned Tony Perkins. If you didn't catch the last segment, Tony Perkins is talking about this ad campaign by Mike and Ike Candy, where they're staging this fictitious divorce between the flavors, between Mike and Ike, and he's calling it, like, part of the gay agenda. It's absolutely hysterical. We played the clip earlier in the show, but at the end of the day, what you've really got is nothing new here. I mean, these are the same people that said that the Teletubbies had a gay agenda, or that Bert and Ernie had a gay agenda. That one I almost actually believe. But their agenda was just being good roommates to each other. So, you know, at some point you have to ask yourself, when does it end? I mean, is this just the last desperate cries for people to pay attention to them? Who knows? Let's talk Hawk in Sacramento. Hey, Hawk.
Oh,
Hawk, are you there?
Hello?
All righty. Maybe next time, Hawk. What about Lou in Everett, Washington? Hey, Lou.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello. You know, earlier when I was driving the car, I was listening to you discussing the economy.
Sure.
And I think the thing that people don't realize is how fraudulent our economy is. One of the areas where I work is equipment for onion farmers. And onion farmers are getting between $40 and $45 a ton for their produce. And, you know, you sit with them in the morning or at the local cafe, and they just drool about the days when they could get $60 a ton. And yet you go into a market, and the best price you can possibly get works out to $1,500 a ton.
Okay.
Where did this markup come from?
For the grocery stores, I'm assuming?
Well, no, because the grocery stores aren't allowed that much markup. There's this whole situation. I mean, it doesn't matter where you look, where we've got this, you know, just fraudulently pricing structure that has, you know, become to the point where it's unquestionable that the markups are acceptable.
Well, and you know, and it's not just food either. It's pretty much everything in the public marketplace. I mean.
Well, even in the industrial marketplace, I mean, it costs about $240 a ton to make basic steel.
Right.
And unless you are literally buying it in half-million-ton lots, you know, you're paying in excess of $1,400 a ton.
Well,
on
Lou,
a good
how do you think that these corporations pay for those giant golden parachutes if they don't have significant markup? They've got to do it some way, and without having a middle class that can afford these products in the numbers that they used to, they need to find other ways to bring the money in. I mean, wages have been flat in this country for going on more than a decade, and that doesn't mean that everything else has been flat in this country. Prices have gone up, rents have gone up, mortgages, you know, the price of homes have gone up until recently, but they're still far exceed what people have been able to make in terms of increased money. You know, one thing, I think it's always important to have some fun. So we've been talking a little bit about Tony Perkins and his crusade against the gay divorce at Mike and Ike. If you are as unsettled and find it just remarkably laughable as much as I do, I encourage you to go buy a couple boxes of Mike and Ike at your local convenience store, help the economy, first of all, and then mail it to Tony Perkins at the Family Research Council. The address there is 801 G Street. That's 801 G Street Northwest, G like the letter, as in Gary, Washington, D.C., 2001. That's 20001. So go buy a couple boxes of Mike and Ike's, and you can go send those to Tony Perkins and let him know that you're fed up and that, you know, if he's looking for a sugar high, perhaps he should just eat the candy and keep his mouth shut. Let's talk to Paul in Fairfield, Oklahoma. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, that's Fairfield, Oklahoma.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Hey, great show. I love it. And just a comment that Tony Perkins is, you know, he's so out of reach. I'm not a gay person.
Right.
But people ought to keep their nose in their own business. And in this country, the religious right, you know, they want separation of church and state. Well, why don't they get out of the making of laws? They don't, you know, they don't have any idea what they're talking about.
Well, they don't believe in separation of church and state, Paul.
They
believe it's in the Constitution. They don't believe it ever existed in the first place.
You know, I'd like to know where the Tea Party is on a lot of this stuff. Why aren't they raising hell up there and about what's going on in Michigan?
Well,
having a dictator take over the damn state.
Well, you know, in the Tea Party, they claimed the whole time that they had no concerns about social issues whatsoever. But then you go and watch these Tea Party rallies where they started in Massachusetts, the people that elected Scott Brown, and they had these crazy right-wing evangelical anti-gay hate group leaders speaking out at these events, saying that you know, using expletives against gay men. And that's what that party is. That's what they're defined by, and that's why they're going to die in a vine. And these are the last grasps of a delusional right. 27 after the hour, this is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. And we will be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, some news in the Trayvon Martin case. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can find me on Twitter at Carl Frisch, at K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. Let's take Lynn in John Day, Oregon. Hey, Lynn.
Hello, can you hear me?
I sure can.
Oh, great. Okay, I'm going to try to make this quick.
All right.
You were talking earlier about, you know, the student loan.
Sure.
A lot of students, well, one researcher school, but, you know, a lot of students, they can't get jobs because look at the degree programs. And a lot of these schools, especially the private ones, they're guilty of false advertising. Like, I guess for several schools, like IT&T has been implicated in several lawsuits for false advertising.
So well, not even just false advertising, but once you get in the door, lying to you about what the degree could be worth. I mean, there was an investigation by the Government Accountability Office two summers ago that found that 15 for-profit colleges tested, four of the 15 that were tested, four encouraged undercover applicants to falsify their financial aid forms to qualify for federal aid, while all 15 made deceptive or otherwise questionable statements. Mm-hmm. And the fictitious prospective applicants that were sent in there as part of the investigation that filled out online forms indicating they had an interest got a barrage of aggressive marketing phone calls at all hours of the day and night. One GAO applicant received more than 180 phone calls in a month trying to get them to sign up for classes at a for-profit college. And I can speak from experience that that is absolutely the case. I once wanted to take some cooking classes so that I could impress my friends at fancy dinner parties by making interesting things. And I Googled online and found one of those schools that said that they were a culinary school. And I thought, oh, let's see how much classes cost and if I might want to take some classes. And I signed up for more information. And I got dozens of phone calls every single day until I finally contacted all the people that had been calling saying, you know, you need to put me on your do not call list. One GAO investigator was actually offered a $14,000 massage therapy certificate and told it was a quote-unquote good value, despite the fact that the same certificate cost only $520 at a local community college. These are the hardball tactics that recruiters use, and they work quite nicely for the bottom lines of these big companies, places like Kaplan and Phoenix and DeVry and ITT. But for the students who end up paying the hefty price, it's far more life-changing than the degrees or certificates that they actually end up receiving. One of the examples that I've seen reported was the case of Michelle Zuver. After finishing a for-profit college program, she was left with $86,000 in debt. And it was all for a degree in criminal justice that is not even recognized by many police agencies. Zuver is not the only student left buried in debt and unable to pursue the dream that they went to college for in the first place. There are so many examples of this. And yet the Republicans who have been, you know, basically paid off by this industry allow this to continue. And it makes no sense. This should be driving Tea Party people crazy. Up to 90% of the money that these for-profit colleges bring in each year is in the form of federal student aid dollars. The University of Phoenix, which is basically like the Walmart of the for-profit college industry, took in 86% of its $3.77 billion this way, just last in 2009. It's probably higher now. And numbers like these should make conservatives, Tea Partiers, they should just be going bonkers. You know, it was the Bush administration that made this possible. And when President Obama tried to tighten the loopholes here, when Tom Harkin, who's head of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, decided to try and tighten the loopholes here, the industry went crazy and Republicans tried to block it every step of the way. But this is one of the reasons that we've got this looming bubble that is going to burst at some point. Some have even likened it to similar to the housing bubble that burst. $1 trillion in student debt. $1 trillion in student debt, which is more than all of the credit card debt in the entire country combined. It's frightening. And it's frightening that we're allowing this to happen all on government dollars. We're pretty darn close to all on government dollars. Sam in Timmonsville, South Carolina. Hey, Sam.
Hello?
Yes.
Am I on television now?
You sure are. Free Speech TV, how are you?
I'm blessed, praise the Lord. I'd like to ask, how come the Occupy media people are not occupying the oil ports down there in New Orleans where they're sending our gasoline and fuel oil to put heating oil? You wonder why the supply and demand don't work.
Right.
They're sending it overseas for $8 or $9 a gallon.
Right. No, I mean, one of the reasons that gas is so expensive in this country is because it's a global market. We're not just talking about the, you know, we have brought and we have created more oil, pulled more oil out of the ground under this president than we did under the last president, and he had 8 years already. And that's not had the impact that it should on the price of gas, because that oil is going right out into a global marketplace where it's competing with oil from all over the world. And that's why those prices haven't come down, because we're talking about the global cost of barrels of oil and not just what we're able to produce here. So this whole lie, drill, baby, drill, we are drilling, but that's not enough to make an impact. There are a lot more factors than the government, than Congress, or even the President of the United States can do to bring gas prices lower. Well, let's take Michael in San Diego. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Mr. Frisch. First off, thoughts and wishes are with Mr. Hartman.
Yes.
I hope him and his wife for handling that situation properly. As for when you were talking to Ms. Dupuy, the reason for our education system is, how do the people in power stay in power? You keep the people stupid. And now, people in power, I'll go from there. Okay. I used to subscribe to a newspaper called The Spotlight, great reporter James Tucker, and nobody ever talks about the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergs, Council on Foreign Relations. What is your opinion on what those people are up to, whether it's benevolent, malevolent? I look forward to your answer.
Well, the problem with conspiracy theories, there's a great book called, I believe it's called Them by John Ronson, who's a BBC reporter, and he goes in and kind of infiltrates all these groups that people like to talk about, the Bilderbergs and so on and so on. The problem with conspiracy theories is that any lack of evidence only further proves how deep the conspiracy actually is. And any evidence that could potentially, even in the slightest way, back up a conspiracy theory only shows how deep the conspiracy actually is. So if somebody's decided that the Bilderbergs and the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations and all these other groups are in some plot to, you know, use us all as, you know, basically pawns in their little worldwide chess game, there's nothing you can do to convince them otherwise. No fact or piece of information will ever convince them otherwise. I don't happen to buy it. I'm not prone to believe in conspiracy theories, and maybe that's why. But I could show proof that they don't exist. And people who believe that it exists would never, ever believe it. They would just see that proof as further proof that that the conspiracy goes much further than they ever thought that it would. And perhaps that's the sad part. I mean, we live in a country where things have gotten so bad economically that we are looking for not necessarily somebody to blame, but certainly something to blame the situation we're on in, where the extremely powerful have gotten more powerful and more wealthy over the last 20-30 years, and the rest of us have been having a hard time making ends meet. And nobody seems to care. We talk about it, but nobody seems to care. The policies that are in place have not been changed that would indicate that they care. So who do you blame? It must be somebody out there. It must be somebody in the shadows. It must be somebody with much more power than I could ever muster. You know, it must be some conspiracy. Otherwise, why wouldn't it just be solved? Why wouldn't we just stand up and say enough is enough? So I empathize with people that end up seeing these things and believing them, but I just don't buy it. I think it's a lot more simple than that. Corporations, the wealthy, want to be wealthy, and they want to stay wealthy. They give lots of money to politicians to make that happen. That's about as simple as it needs to be. It's Occam's razor, right? The most likely explanation is probably the true explanation. Let's take Frank in Cambridge. Hey, Frank.
Oh, hi. I thought it was ironic that you mentioned that about the body massage classes for $14,000. I was laid off about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And I didn't see any chance of getting back into my old profession, so I thought I'd try something new, and I started looking around. I got an email from a place called, Body Massage School Classic. It was over in Watertown, Mass.
Yeah.
And I returned the email, and I'd say within 15 minutes to half an hour, I got a call
right.
from the receptionist, from the woman. And she invited me over there to, and I was excited about this because I thought I really wanted to do
sure.
it.
Sure.
You know, so I drove over there and I went through this whole process of, you know, talking to the president of the college, you know, and all this. And, then they wanted me to sit in on a class. And so I did. I sat in on the class. But a couple of things struck me at first was that, it was gender bias. Mostly it's women.
Okay.
So I mentioned that to one of the personnel people.
You know what, Frank? We're running out of time at this break. It's hard break. I've got to let you go there.
Okay.
I'll pick up the subject on the other side. Thanks a lot, Frank. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch. We're taking your calls. 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, we're taking your calls and more with me, Carl Frisch.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit CarlFrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. It is 10 till the bottom of the hour. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We're taking your calls. Lacey, who is a teacher in Seattle. Hey, Lacey.
Yes. Hi, Carl. I teach at a, I don't want to say the name,
That's
at
okay.
a local for-profit school here. I graduated in 2010 with a master's degree and was lucky enough that qualified me to teach part-time at this school. I personally have a pile of student loan debt, and I think it's kind of sadly ironic that I am teaching all these students and I'm in a position where I should be telling them that, oh, you're going to go out, you're going to find a job, it's
right.
going to be great, and I just feel like it's a big lie, and I can't really say otherwise to them.
Well, and that's the problem with the industry as a whole. I mean, I would not say that every single degree gotten by every single student at a for-profit college is a bad deal. But there are too many that just don't make it square, that take on huge debt for a degree that may not be what they think they're getting. And then the numbers aren't there. They don't get jobs in the same numbers that other college graduates do. They don't they don't see their income grow in the same way that other college graduates do. They just don't hit any of the same benchmarks. And yet almost all of the money that goes into the for-profit college industry is from the federal government.
That's true. And I know that's a problem. Personally, I went to a public university and got my BA and MA there. And all of my classmates that I graduated with have also struggled. So that's, I think, an important point to make
sure.
alongside the for-profit.
Well, everybody's struggling, but the numbers do not lie that if you go to a for-profit college that you're going to be in less better position than if you go to, other colleges. I mean, it's
yes.
true. Everybody that's coming out of college right now is struggling.
Yes.
That's the truth. I mean, young people today face double the unemployment that other people in this country face. And so many more, it used to be that when you were 24, you might be figuring out what it's like to live alone without a college roommate for the first time. And now everybody's learning what it's like to live in mom and dad's basement on the couch. And thankfully this president has done a lot to lower the unemployment rate and put opportunities out there. And hopefully, we'll see some of that change. Joining me now is Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. Hello, Victoria.
Hello.
What's happening out there at the White House?
Well, President Obama issued an executive order today that allows U.S. officials for the first time to impose sanctions against foreign nationals, this is companies and individuals, found to have used new technologies, including cell phone tracking and internet monitoring, to help carry out grave human rights abuses.
Would that qualify against News Corp and Rupert Murdoch?
No, it would qualify against companies in Syria and Iraq.
Right, yeah, primarily Syria right now too, right?
Right, exactly. But in the future, it could apply to companies and individuals in other countries as well.
And it just it doesn't have to be perpetrated from our shores. They just have to be American companies that are doing this, right?
I don't know that they have to be American companies that are doing it.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the decision is that the countries that use these products can receive sanctions.
No, it's to target the companies and the individuals. I mean, these countries are already under great sanctions. This is to target the companies and individuals. It's to go after the companies who are doing it.
And what's the reception been like thus far?
It's been pretty good thus far, actually. Pretty good. He also announced a set of U.S. Development Challenge grants designed to encourage technology companies to develop new ways to help residents in countries that are vulnerable to mass killings better detect and quickly alert others to impending dangers. And he's also unveiled a high-level government panel to serve as a clearinghouse for real-time intelligence policymaking and other issues related to mass killing.
Is that are people saying that's maybe in response to the big Joseph Kony, uprising that's happened over the last, 6 months?
It's hard to tell whether it's in response to that or whether it's something more. You don't get any sense that it's in response to any one thing, quite honestly.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. It certainly seems as if the White House is kicking into a much more aggressive posture as things heat up on the White House on the campaign trail.
Yes, indeed. They also imposed more sanctions on Syria today, but of course they're being criticized for their position on Syria for not arming the Syrian opposition militarily, and they continue to come under a lot of criticism for that. Meantime, over in the Senate, watch out for the big vote tomorrow on postal reform.
Right. This is something that I've been following very closely. I mean, there is no postal crisis that wasn't created by Congress, as far as I'm concerned. You've got that that healthcare mandate that Congress put in saying that the Postal Service, unlike every other agency in government and unlike any other company in the country, has to fund the retirement of its workers 100% for the next 70 years, meaning that somebody who is not yet born until 2027, their retirement, if they could potentially work for the post office, has to be fully funded for 70 years. It's an absurd amount of money that they're being forced to put aside, and hopefully the Senate will do something about that.
Well, it looks like they're going to address it partially, maybe not going as far as the Postmaster General would like them to. It seems like what they're doing is a half measure and may not address all of the issues, but they've got a deadline. Postal Service says it's going to be insolvent by May the 15th.
Which would be the first time that that's ever happened since the Nixon administration restructured things and made the post office pay for itself through the sale of postage stamps, which it was able to do until Congress changed this policy in 2006. This is the first time, year after year, that we've been in the red in the post office. It was black up until then. Anyways, I want to thank Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. I want to thank Tom Hartman, Louise, and all of the great team here at Team Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.